Dr. Tracy Punchin. And Dr. Punchin is a research assistant professor in the Biological Sciences Department of Dartmouth College. She joined the Dartmouth Superfund Research Program as a trainee in 2005 and remains part of the program in the Trace Elements Analysis Core facility. Now, Dr. Punchin has over 15 years' experience with elemental mapping, working closely with three of the U.S. synchrotron facilities, and routinely using laser ablation ICP-MS. So thank you, Tracy, and go ahead.
Hi, can you all hear me?
Yes, yep. Thank you.
Okay, so this is my title slide. Thanks for the introduction. Thanks to Sarah and John. This is an overview of what I'm going to talk about today. Firstly, I wanted to say that my talk today is kind of low-tech introduction to elemental mapping, so I deliberately haven't gone into too much technical detail about sample prep, about how the different quantification methods work. So this is really a kind of a translation activity for elemental mapping to kind of bring people who don't know so much about the technique into contact with it and what it can do, so that they get to decide for themselves really whether this can be something that they could use in their research. I'm going to define what elemental mapping is, and then I'm going to give you, for the bulk of my talk, some scientific applications of where elemental mapping has been used in instances where bulk elemental measurements aren't sufficient. I'm going to try in one short slide to help people navigate how they might go ahead and choose an imaging technique for their work. And then I'm going to focus really on the two techniques that I have the most expertise in, and that's synchrotron, X-ray fluorescence mapping, and laser ablation. And then at the end, hopefully I'm going to be able to put you in touch with some how you could access these techniques for yourself if you're interested. So firstly, to define elemental mapping, mapping is a mode of chemical analysis. So it operates in various with various instruments, but it is a way of analyzing materials that give you information not only about how much metal or element is there, but also the spatial information or where that metal is in the context of the sample. And there are various configurations of elemental mapping. As you can see here, 1D is just line scans or profiles where at each point you get count information, so you get abundance information about your element on the x-axis. 2D is what we would define as the classic elemental map, where you have each point, not only do you have count information, but you have x and y coordinates, and we call those pixels. When you're in a three-dimensional mode, those points are called voxels, and each point has not only abundance, but x, y, and often theta, which is the angle of rotation, or z-axis. And then up-and-coming techniques include 4D analysis. This is, would be a three-dimensional volume that is updated in time, so the fourth dimension would be time, and this is something that the technique is moving into this area. So the terminology really that I use in elemental mapping to distinguish elemental mapping from other modes of elemental analysis is to call it volume averaged, is where you've got bulk analysis, like ICP-MS, where the specimen structure is completely destroyed and homogenized before analysis, usually dissolved. But elemental mapping is spatially resolved, so that's where the opposite happens, where the specimen structure is actually preserved prior to analysis. So to visualize these different modes, these different configurations, you can see here that I'm just trying to get my pointer, it doesn't work. You have 1D analysis where you get a line scan. Then in the middle here, under 2D, this is an elemental map of a three-dimensional object. So this is a rice grain. And you can see here that there's one element being shown here, and it's on a rainbow color scale. So usually, this is very commonly used in elemental mapping, so the warmer the color, the more red the color, the higher the elemental concentration. And then over here, this is an example of a three-dimensional elemental map, and there are three different elements shown here, iron, manganese, and zinc. And this is really a reminder that this is usually a multi-elemental technique. With synchrotron, it's simultaneously multi-elemental. With laser ablation, it's sequential, but it's still very fast collection time. So this is an Arabidopsis seed. So what you're seeing here is iron in the veins, manganese at the outer surfaces, the lower surfaces of the leaves, and then you have zinc here as well. So when you have these three configurations, what you need to know about this is the way the stage is moving. So when you see elemental mapping techniques, it is the stage or your sample that moves, and it's never the beam. In these examples, I'll be using either an X-ray beam or a laser beam. They are static, and your stage is moving around, your sample is moving around. So with 1D analysis, you have two things to consider. You have a distance that the stage is moving, and you have the size of the beam. In 2D analysis, this is just rastering across, so this is the direction that the map, the stage will move in, and this will be the analysis of your sample. So if you think about this, the distance between these beams is the coverage of your sample. So the further apart these spots are, the less of your sample that you will be analyzing, and the more of your sample that will be interpolated. So when you show an elemental map, the software will be interpolating between these points. So if they're further apart, that interpolation will be greater, so less of your sample is analyzed. So when you do three-dimensional tomography or three-dimensional analysis, there's several different modes here. This is this really refers to laser ablation, a destructive technique where you can etch away at the surface and progressively etch deeper into the sample to get a three-dimensional volume. With X-ray analysis, this is a non-destructive technique, and what happens is you can put your sample on a rotational stage and scan across it, and then the stage will rotate slightly, and then you can scan across it again until you've gone through 360 degrees, and then you will reconstruct that into a tomogram, and that is something, another, you do stacks of these images to build up a three-dimensional volume. So there are numerous scientific applications of elemental mapping. About 20 years ago, it was really restricted to environmental or material science and mineralogy, but recently it's become used in the biological sciences, and that's really as a result of technological advancements and more sensitive detection. So the example that I'm going to talk through today are some contaminant distribution in soils, mineral associations, changes in elemental bioavailability or distribution with time. Petrography is another great application. Entry and movement through biota. So it's very relevant to the Superfund research. We can also move into biological organisms. We can use elemental mapping to look at the genetic control of elemental homeostasis. Modes of toxicity, we can really use it to look at elemental perturbations in biota, and as that four-dimensional, that time-resolved analysis comes in, we're going to be able to look at chemical signaling, which is something that happens over very short periods of time, but involves changes in elemental compositions. And also we can use it to look at human health. It's increasingly being used to look at biomarkers about environmental exposure, to make them into time-resolved records of exposure, such as teeth and hair. So I'll be showing these examples. And the first one is a soil contaminant example. And this is because we're in the Superfund program. This is a Superfund-funded research. This is an elemental map of some sediments that were collected from the Iron King mine and the Humboldt Smelter Superfund site in Arizona. So what you're looking at here is an elemental map of soil. So you have two elements shown here, and where they overlap, you have a yellow coloration where they spatially overlap. This elemental map has arsenic on it. This contaminated sediments contain about 3,000 ppm of arsenic. So what this paper is looking at is whether this arsenic is becoming more bioavailable as these sediments weather. So they've used the technique here of being able to do correlations, which is another thing that you can do with the huge amount of data that you get with elemental mapping, is really statistically explore those elemental co-associations. You can screen out features that you're not interested in so that you can focus on the ones that you really want to examine in more detail. So this is really successful use of elemental mapping. To use a very contrasting example, so this is a water flea, this is Daphnia magna. So whereas soil and sediments are very stable samples, and they would be easier to measure, Biological samples can often be very delicate, very fragile, have very short lives in front of the beam or in front of a laser beam, very delicate. So this is Daphnia, and this has been done, this was resin embedded, or chemically stabilized before it was analyzed. But what they've done is they've exposed it to zinc, and then they've measured the zinc distribution within the body. They've used some complementary laboratory techniques, such as computed tomography, to show the structure of the animal, and then they've overlaid the two images on top of one another to give you a look at where these elements are in the context of the animal. So if you have applications where you have small organisms that you think are very fragile, elemental mapping can still access these specimens. Here's another application of entry and movement of contaminants through biota. This is a map, a three-dimensional tomogram volume of a rice grain showing the distribution of arsenic in the grain. So this grain was artificially pulsed with arsenite, and then it was measured by computed tomography at the National Synchrotron Light Source. So the grayscale image is actually a PIN diode, which is a density. It's collected after the sample, so the x-rays that are moving through the sample, it gives you a feel of the density of the tissue. And the rainbow image is actually the arsenic moving through the ovular vascular trace of the rice grain. Another nice application that came recently is the ability to look at fresh plant material using synchrotron. This was done at the NSLS, and this is an example of where we can do genetic manipulations to plant tissue, and then we can use elemental mapping to show the effects of those genetic manipulation. So this is a wild-type alfalfa leaf where the calcium generally accumulates in the veins as calcium oxalate crystals, and this is undesirable because it causes digestive problems in cattle, and it also makes the calcium biologically unavailable. So these researchers knocked out the gene COD5, and then we used the synchrotron to look at, you used elemental mapping to look at what this deletion or silencing of this gene did to the calcium distribution, and we found that it actually, there is now no calcium in the veins, and all of the calcium has been redistributed throughout the lamina of the leaf and is more biologically available. Coming to the example of human health and exposure, so this is one-dimensional line profile, which you may think is a sort of a low-tech use of elemental mapping, but it's actually very valuable for looking at things like teeth, things that have accretionary growth characteristics. So this has been used to look at the lead in human teeth, and you can see here what I've overlaid the actual the concentration of lead that was measured all along this line. On this panel you have baby teeth, deciduous baby teeth, and this was done by laser ablation at the Dartmouth Trace Element Analysis Lab, showing you calcium and lead. Baby teeth are very good indications of the elemental exposures in the womb. So teeth begin to develop in the womb, and when they're shed, we can measure them, and they're very good records of exposure, especially for lead. And here's another interesting example. This one is a skin biopsy from a person who was taking colloidal silver supplements, and their skin had turned blue. So this was a laser ablation of silver in the skin biopsy, showing you the epidermis here and the dermis. And we've overlaid it on a visual light micrograph of the skin biopsy. And this was, again, done by laser ablation. And then a final example is using, this was done with laser ablation again, looking at food chain transfer. This was done with cadmium-selenium quantum dots in the benthic amphipod Leptochirus. So these two panels are showing you Leptochirus that was exposed to cadmium and selenium quantum dots via the water that it lives in. And on these panels, Leptochirus was exposed via an algae. So the algae was fed the quantum dots, and the Leptochirus was fed the algae. And what you can see here is where it's just living in the quantum dot contaminated water, the cadmium and selenium distributions overlay almost completely, but where the Leptochirus is actually fed the algae that's been fed quantum dots, you can see There's a greater concentration, there's a greater distribution of both cadmium and selenium, and they don't overlay completely, so there's evidence there that there's been some dissolution as it's moved through the food chain. So those are my examples, hopefully nice to look at examples of where elemental mapping's been used. But how would you, if you wanted to use it, this technique, how would you decide which one was right for you? So what I've tried to do here is to put the two most important aspects on a scale. Firstly, how big is your sample? So this is a spatial scale and this is a concentration scale. So how big is the specimen that you want to look at? That's a consideration. And what is the volume average concentration of the metals it contains? As you can see, there's still quite a blank area here. Some of the techniques just can't get down below the parts per billion range when your concentrations are very low, although I'm sure that the technology will move in that direction. But synchrotron and laser ablation are both very sensitive techniques that I'm going to talk about next. And there are other techniques like secondary ion mass spectroscopy or particle-induced X-ray emission that are very sensitive. But these are slightly different techniques. They're sort of superficial techniques. They look at the surface of your sample. With synchrotron, the X-ray beam usually penetrates through your sample, depending on the thickness. And laser ablation, again, is a destructive technique, and it can be used to etch deep into your sample. So if you decide that you want to use a synchrotron-based technique, you have about six U.S. synchrotron facilities that you can go to. This is I put a nice picture of the Crab Nebula from which you will see natural synchrotron light emitting. This is the blue light, and that's what it looks like when you see it in pictures of the synchrotron. It's a bright blue light. So if you want to go to one of these synchrotron facilities, they're user facilities, so you can apply to go and do your experiments there. You fill in a short form online that involves describing what you want to do. It's peer-reviewed or it's scientifically reviewed. Your costs really involve just your travel and your accommodation, but the use of the synchrotron itself is free. The beam line or the beam is operational 24 hours a day, so it's best to take a team of people with you. And training and support is all provided. And again, many of the techniques are non-destructive, so you can leave with your sample intact. So when you're at the synchrotron and the synchrotron beam strikes your sample, what you're actually measuring there is the element's response as it becomes energized as a result of the synchrotron beam, and they're rearranging their electrons to regain stability. So they're fluorescing, and we measure this fluorescence, and we get this nice spectrum with all of these elements. This was from a hard synchrotron X-ray fluorescence spectrum from a hard X-ray beamline. And so at each one of your pixels or voxels, this is the information that you're getting. And as technologies move forward, we now get this entire spectrum at each point. So if you go back and decide you want to look for an element that you didn't think of when you collected the data, you can go back and interrogate this spectrum. And I just wanted to point out that there are sort of the caveats to synchrotron analysis, as there are to any technique or for this kind of elemental mapping, is that what can happen here is you get spectral overlap. So you can get things, if you're looking for cadmium, for instance, and you have a biological specimen that has a lot of potassium, then this is not the energy window that you would need to be in. You'd need to be up at 26 keV. Likewise, if you're looking for arsenic in a sample you suspect might have also lead in it, this is another thing you need to be aware of. There will be spectral overlap, and you have to change energies to see both of those elements. So laser ablation is another technique. This is far more accessible in that these instruments, you don't have to travel to a special facility to use these instruments. They're benchtop instruments. It's a similar principle in that there's a laser striking your sample, but the physical disturbance of all of the particulates is what you're actually measuring. So these particulates are swept into the ICP-MS. And so the things that you have to consider in this technique are the power and the frequency of the laser, how your sample behaves when the laser strikes it, the efficiency of which these particles are driven into the ICP-MS. The availability of standards is also a very big consideration in laser ablation, because there aren't laser ablation standards that are commercially available. and again, this is the multi-elemental analysis is sequential, so the more elements that you want to look at, the longer it's going to take you to count them. Again, we're still talking in seconds or fractions of a second, but it is a consideration. Another thing you need to think about with ICP-MS is interferences. So this is pretty well described in ICP-MS, but just to give you an indication, even though you have a 7,000 degree plasma, so the particles are being swept into this plasma, it can lead to the formation of these polyatomics. So for instance, if you were analyzing arsenic, you would have to be aware of a typical polyatomic argon chloride, which has the same mass as arsenic, because again, this is being analyzed by a mass spectrometer. You also have, there is also doubly charged ion formation. So the way that this is handled in ICP-MS is by collision cell or reaction cell technology. Now, I've put collision cell here, but actually that's an error. That's a reaction cell. The example I'm giving you is if you're looking at arsenic and you want to avoid the argon chloride interferences, you react the arsenic with oxygen. So this is a reaction gas, not a collision. This is a reaction cell. And you get arsenic oxide, which is then only mass 91 enters this the quadrupole. And so you get all of these interferences removed. So again, ICP-MS is a much more sensitive way of quantifying your elements. Many of these interferences are known and we can correct for them. So this is a very good form of elemental mapping and one that's enjoyed a lot of technological advancements recently. So access, if you're interested in accessing elemental mapping, it used to have a reputation as being inaccessible, but I think that's really changed now. For synchrotron access, as someone who sits on a review panel for synchrotron beam time, the web pages of beamlines and synchrotron facilities will guide you to the facility that you can use. The first thing you really need to do is speak to the beamline scientists. You phone them up and speak to them about the experiment that you'd like to do. In fact, when you submit your proposal, that is one of the boxes that you have to check, is have you spoken to someone? And they will give you a huge amount of information about where you need to go, how you need to prepare your sample, and exactly how to do it. And then they will even help you write the beam time proposal, which is a short web form, but it can be difficult to do at times if you don't put the right information, but to speak to the beamline scientists and they'll tell you what to put in. For access to laser ablation, one thing you could do is contact the Dartmouth Trace Element Analysis Corps. We currently do a lot of laser ablation and collaborations. So this is just a little plug for the Dartmouth Trace Element Analysis Corps. We have numerous ICP-MS instruments, and we also have a new wave research laser ablation unit, which has a large stage, which allows us to do multiple samples or very large samples. We do quantitative analysis, speciation, and of course, spatial. And this is just a picture of the Dartmouth Superfund Research Group. And with that, I will take any questions. Hello?
Thanks, Tracy. So did anybody submit, if you want to, submit questions through the Q&A pod? Don't see any here, but we can open our phone line. If those on the phone have questions, please unmute your phone by pressing #6.
And John, there is one question that's come in through. I just want to make sure that you saw it through the Q&A.
Go ahead with that. I didn't see it.
Okay. So one question that's come through that says, because the sample rotates and the beam is stationary, the sediment sample analysis, for example, requires preparation, so the contacts do not spatially shift.
Yes, they would. They would. Yes, that might be, I think there are ways of getting around that, but yes, you wouldn't want to put a loose powder. I mean, we're talking about, for tomography, some quite small, so submicron, or, you know, hundreds of microns sample size would be ideal. So you know, individual grains would be easy to analyze, but sort of large collections of grains, yeah, they'd have to be stabilized in some way. And there are numerous embedding resins that are invisible to x-rays that you can use for that.
Okay, this is John. So we have another question from one of our attendees that said, are facilities available for commercial applications like rental?
Yes, when you go to a synchrotron, you can do proprietary research there. But yes, you have to pay for that. There is a cost for proprietary research, yes. The application procedure is just the same, and you just have to check that you're doing proprietary research.
Okay, our next question is, you mentioned that matrix match standards. Are there particular matrices or materials that are difficult to measure because standards aren't available? That's a good question.
Human hair is pretty difficult because if you powder it up and then try and press it into a pellet, so that's what we do when we're making a laser ablation standard. We sort of use the NIST standards and press them into pellets, but hair doesn't like to be pressed into a pellet when it's ground up. And it's still quite heterogeneous, so we really need to work on getting standards for those. Plant tissue specimens can be difficult because, again, if you're measuring a leaf, you're usually going for laser ablation, usually ablating through a wax layer, which has very different physical properties with the laser. So yeah, this is a huge area where we spend a great deal of our time, is trying to get the most appropriate standard. Because the matrix it's in alters the physics of its distribution, or it's being swept into the ICP-MS, the way it behaves when it's ablated. So yeah, that is a big challenge.
Okay. Any other questions? Those are all the ones from our Q&A box. Oh, we have one more. Hold on. The next question is, do you believe the LA ICP-MS to be a quantitative technique?
I do, yes. I do, when properly done and when you get the right matrix match standards.
Okay.
I mean, I think synchrotron is also a quantitative technique. It's just there are several, levels of how meaningful it is on that scale for one individual specimen. Say it's one seed or it's one tiny organism, whether you can interpret those concentrations meaningfully, whether it's representative of the population. But yes, I think it can be quantitative, and I think it's moving rapidly in that direction.
Okay. All right, so I think another question we have here, I think we have to take a couple more and then move on. Is that right for timing?
We're pretty good on time, so I think the questions that have come in at this point, you can go ahead and ask.
Okay. So the next question that came in is, does Brookhaven have a synchrotron facility?
Yes, it does. It has recently just opened the National Synchrotron Light Source 2. NSLS-1 is closed down. NSLS-2 is open, and it's just open, so it's one of the most powerful in the world right now, I guess, until someone builds another one. So, yeah, it has a great facility, and it has, I believe, a biological village. So it has really opened up to the biological user community in its new facility. So, yes, it does.
And there's another question about the six. Could you name the six facilities? But you gave their acronym on your slide, but I don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry. So CHESS is the Cornell High Energy Synchrotron, I think. ALS is the Advanced Light Source, SSRL is the Stanford Synchrotron Radiation Light Source, then is NSLS is the National Synchrotron Light Source, and what's the other one? APS, Advanced Photon Source, I think, was it? Did I get them all? I need to go back to that slide.
You can go back to that slide if you want. I would mention, too, I know this from the work that we do using the synchrotron, there's different power. So
yes.
the KMD and the APS are different power. So the APS is much more powerful than KMD. So APS is the one we tend to use more.
I think that's KMD is the Center for Advanced Microstructures and Devices.
Yeah. It's an LSU.
So it's a smaller one. NSLS2 is huge. APS is huge. SSRL is a smaller one. It's a favorite of mine as well because it's smaller, you don't get so much beam damage, and you can actually still put unprepared, you know, fresh biological specimens in front of the beam, and they won't burn and degrade. But these bigger synchrotrons like NSLS2 and APS are very, very powerful, and they are, you know, really targeting the nanoparticle user community and trying to get down to those kind of spatial scales. So the beam power is huge. What the NSLS2 is trying to do is give a tunable beam and different scales to the biological community. So there are specific beam lines at NSLS2 that is hopefully will allow you to kind of turn down that and look at sort of fresh biological specimens again.
So, although our listeners are asking about using this directly, really you need a specialist in this area because synchrotrons are very, well, it's a complex area. And people
you do, yeah. But again, speaking to a beamline scientist, they're very, very keen to have new users go and, you know, push the boundaries of the technique. And so they're very helpful, and they will, you know, train you on how to use the beamline and or use it with, or, you know, you do it for you if you have difficulty. So, yeah.
Okay. And then one more question for you. How do you account for uneven ablation? This is using laser ablation. How do you account for uneven ablation as the sample surface changes as you're, you know, burning it off, yeah, basically with a laser?
So what you get to do with laser ablation is you can focus every individual point on the Z-axis to make sure that it is in focus. What we have is we've got various levels and ways of making sure the sample is flat. But, yeah, you have a variable focus, so you can account for the uneven surfaces with laser ablation. It is best if it is a completely flat surface. But again, you can account for small changes in that Z-axis. And the software that you have with the laser ablation, you know, actually putting your sample points on there that you want to ablate, is in some ways more advanced than synchrotrons and some beam lines. But again, you can still account for variable focus.
Very good. Thank you for your presentation. Many good questions on that one as well.
You're welcome.
But if we could, can we move to our next presentation? If you have submitted any questions that we didn't get to, we may have time at the end to ask, but if not, we'll pass any open questions to the presenter. So don't let this stop the Q&As coming in for this particular presentation. We can forward them on to the presenter if you come up with a question later. Okay, so now I think we're going to switch to Bruce Buchholz's presentation. There we are. Next we'll hear from Dr. Bruce Buchholz, and Dr. Buchholz was formerly trained in the physical sciences. Obtained his PhD in nuclear engineering from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in Illinois. He did a postdoc at Argonne National Lab in the Chemical Technology Division, where he worked on removal of radioisotopes from hazardous wastes and medical isotope production technology. Now he moved on to UC Davis, where he did a short postdoc with Bruce Hammack and started applying accelerator mass spectrometry to biological systems. And from there, he settled at the Center for Accelerator Mass Spectrometry, CAMS, at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, where he continues his association with the UC Davis SRP and performed the first human microdosing studies using AMS. He is currently a senior scientist at CAMS and continues to use the AMS in a wide variety of biological applications. And Bruce, if you could begin, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that introduction. Today I'm going to describe how to use accelerator mass spectrometry, or AMS, to do metabolite quantitation and biomarker development, principally in humans. So outline today, I'm going to describe what accelerator mass spectrometry, AMS, is, what it can do and how you can use it, go through a few applications in biological tracing, looking at food carcinogens and toxins, pesticide metabolism and biomarker development, PAH ingestion, and a summary, and then also look at future trends. Biological AMS was really invented at Lawrence Livermore by Ken Turteltaub, John Vogel, in the late 1980s. The first paper using it came out in PNAS in 1990. AMS was developed in the late 1970s. It's really an isotope ratio mass spectrometry technique. You can see in the slide, it's a picture of our webpage with a URL there. We're funded by the National Institutes of Health. We are an NIGMS center. We have a PI collaborator user model. You can go to the website, you can see how you can access AMS and through us. We've really concentrated on technology advances to make the technology more user-friendly. There are about 10 PhD scientists that are part of the RR team. We have about 20 active scientific collaborations at any one time. We do service work for people that have experience with AMS. Been working with the Superfund group at Davis really my entire time in California for about the past 20 years. We've been working with the Oregon State SRP probably about 7 or 8 years, and when I first came, we were working with the Berkeley group, but we don't have any active projects with them at the moment. So I mentioned before, AMS is a isotope ratio mass spec technique. We're using a rare, long-lived radioisotope as the isotope that we want to measure. Half-lives between 10 and 10 million years. Here's a periodic table of elements that have isotopes in that range. Isotopes shorter than 10 years, you can do decay counting on fairly well. Longer than 10 million years, there's a natural concentration that tends to be too high to do AMS very well. Carbon-14 is the most commonly used isotope in AMS, by far the most widely measured. It was developed for doing radiocarbon dating initially, and we've been doing it using elevated amounts of 14 to do tracing for several decades. So what are we actually doing, and where do you get the big payoff? Counting radioactivity is really inefficient if you have something that has a long radioactive half-life, like carbon-14. The half-life is 5,700 years, so you spend a lot of time waiting for decays to happen. You can see that to count just a 0.1% of the C14 in a sample, you'd spend over 8 years, which is really not tolerable for anyone. What we do in AMS is that we ionize individual atoms, and we use a negative ion initially, and then actually count the atoms. So we can measure the large number of charged particles much more quickly than waiting for decays. And this allows us to have very good sensitivity in the atomole range. So here's a picture of our big facility, the big spectrometer that measures everything from tritium to plutonium. The reason we want to use a isotope tracer is that any fluorescent tag that you're anything else you would put on a molecule will change the molecule. By having an intrinsic label in a molecule that you want to trace, you're not changing the chemistry at all. And here you can see the different concentrations of the natural isotopes of carbon. Carbon-14 is about one part per trillion. And what we do is exploit the rarity of the carbon-14 to trace carbon atoms. So think, well, why not just use carbon-13? And the reason is the background. I have an example of atrazine here. It's a triazine herbicide. Formula weight is a bit over 200. There are 8 carbon atoms, 3 carbons in the triazine ring. You could label all of these. My pointer. So there's a ring. You could put a 13 on all the carbon atoms to have 8 and to make a tracer. for carbon-14 tracing for AMS, we'll put one carbon-14 in one-tenth of the molecules. So if you wanted to quantify concentrations in urine of somebody who had this at part per million, the carbon-13 concentration here would only increase by about 0.03%. You can measure that with a good IRMS, but it's not a big difference from what's naturally occurring. The carbon-14 concentration would increase by a factor of 100,000, which is an enormous signal-to-noise over the natural concentration. So what using a C14 label gives us this big signal-to-noise. So instead of measuring part per million, we're measuring part per billion, part per trillion, parts per quadrillion of tracer compounds. Really, really low concentrations. We have small, well-defined samples and convert them to graphite for typical analysis. So we take blood or tissue or an HPLC fraction or protein or DNA. We combust it to carbon dioxide and then reduce it to graphite, basically the same material that's in the lead of your pencil. Obviously, this destroys the chemical information, so you need to know what you start with before we start doing the analyses. A big advantage of these small blood samples is that we can draw a lot of samples and get very good profiles of concentrations of compounds going into circulation and then clearing. So we can get very good PK curves with this technique. Often we don't get a milligram of carbon for HPLC fractions, proteins, or DNA, so we have to add a carbon carrier to bulk up the sample. We have very well-established carrier. We use tributyrin because it has a lot of great properties, and been doing that for many years. So carbon-14 is radioactive. What's the effect on radiation risk and radioactive waste? This graphic has a radiation dose on the vertical axis, SI units of nanosieverts. 5,000 nanosieverts is a half a millirem. Biological mean life on the horizontal axis. Looking at a standard man, which is 70 kilograms, that's used for radiation protection. Standard man has 100 nanocuries of carbon-14 naturally. So the dose that we typically would get, or what we often get with AMS studies, is the radiation doses we can express in hours of plane flight or in numbers of bananas consumed, because the biological lives, mean lives are relatively short. Most of these compounds are cleared very quickly. There's very little radiological dose. So in most cases, no samples are actually radioactive that we measure. The low dose allows us to basically have a significant reduction in radiological waste as well. If you can't measure any additional radioactivity, the material in most cases is not considered radioactive. And this is language from the Federal Register. So below 0.05 microcuries of tritium or carbon-14 per gram in an animal tissue is considered non-radioactive. So some of the first work that was done with Ken Turteltaub was looking at food carcinogens. So they looked at FIP and methyl IQX. Traditionally, these compounds are given at very, very high doses, on the order of 10,000 hamburgers a day, for example, for the amount of FIP you could get in a hamburger. When you do that, you can get tumors formed on livers quite easily. The issue is that nobody's going to eat that kind of a dose. So what we were looking at is how do we move from the experimental regime measuring out here and linearly extrapolate down to an environmental or an occupational. What AMS allows us to do is actually work in this regime so we can see is the dose response linear? Is there some threshold is it nonlinear because there are multiple pathways in which something could be metabolized? And we're able to then actually look at what's happening in reality, not go to some extrapolate many orders of magnitude backwards. So here's a graph from a paper that was published quite a while ago comparing FIP binding in DNA to people and rats. People were given a small amount of radioactive FIP that were going to have surgery, and we were able to collect the tumors that were being excised and then extract the DNA, look at FIP adducts. This is rats. Found that the people had much higher adduct levels than a rat. I wonder, does that mean that people are more prone to forming FIP adducts? And what happens is that you have different metabolism occurring. So humans and mice do not metabolize FIP the same way. The rodents tend to form a non-reactive metabolite principally. Humans form a DNA binding metabolite preferentially. So you have different metabolite profiles with different species, not surprising. Let's look at another compound that you find in food, aflatoxin. This work was done at Oregon State. Aflatoxin is a mycotoxin associated with mold prone foods. It's often found in corn, cottonseed, peanuts, and milk. I think peanuts is probably the most common place you find it. Animal studies suggested that chlorophyll and chlorophyllin can reduce the bioavailability of aflatoxin in animal models. So at Oregon State, found four volunteers to ingest 5 nanocuries of C14 aflatoxin. And the chemical dose was a fraction of that was found in a peanut butter sandwich. So you can see that you don't have issues really of safety when going through an IRB, because people don't really worry about the amount of aflatoxin they get when they eat a peanut butter sandwich. We're then able to measure concentrations of C14 in blood and urine. Then the same for volunteers. Did the study again after several weeks, the aflatoxin, labeled aflatoxin, and then having it with chlorophyll or chlorophyllin. What we found is that the bioavailability was significantly lower with the chlorophyll and chlorophyllin. So the lesson here is that if you're going to eat peanut butter sandwich, throw a piece of lettuce on along with it. Let's go back to our friend atrazine, looking at a dermal exposure study. This is the first project I actually worked on when I came out to California. The study looking to determine the metabolites of atrazine and human dermal exposure so that you could then come up with a biomarker and develop an immunoassay for it. So the atrazine had ring-labeled carbon-14, atrazine has a chlorine on the top. This is an amino ethyl amino isopropyl group. So the reason the label was purely on the ring is that these groups get chopped off, so you don't want to put a label there if you're tracing the compound. This study was not designed for AMS. It was designed to do metabolite analyses using scintillation counting based on animal models. After the study was done, we found that there was very little activity actually in the urine, not enough to do a metabolite separation. So we learned that humans and rats do not absorb atrazine the same way. So we thought, how can we salvage this clinical study? So we had all the samples. Urine was collected pre-dose during the 24 hours of exposure and then daily afterwards. We separated metabolites by HPLC, collected fractions, and then quantified by AMS. Okay, so this is data from one subject. Before doing the HPLC separation, we decided which samples are we going to analyze. We had too many samples to do a 50-minute HPLC separation and separate and collect and analyze all those fractions. So we got a pre-dose sample, one sample while the atrazine was in contact with the skin, so the concentration was increasing. Our peak one, which was day two for all the subjects, and then a sample that's out later on the trace. So we, for different subjects, we analyzed different points here to see if there was a difference. There really wasn't much when we got out this far. So the data would look like this. The blue is the UV trace. The red are histograms of C14. It's in femtomoles of carbon-14 per mil of urine. You can see that the blue peaks do not always line up with the red peaks. And that tells us is that the blue peaks are compounds in the urine that are absorbing. The red peaks are purely from the atrazine. So these are all different metabolites of atrazine that are eluting at different times. And what we see is that the metabolite profile shifted significantly during and after exposure. So the red here is the 4 to 8 hours, blue is day two, and yellow is day seven. So I've normalized the concentrations for each day. As you saw, remember a couple slides back, the day two is much higher than day seven. I did this so that the graphs were approximately the same height. You can see over time, the metabolites are becoming more polar. This at 39 minutes was atrazine mercaptrate, which we selected as the best compound for making a bioassay or immunoassay for atrazine exposure. In every case, there was no parent compound found. A parent compound comes out here at about 42 minutes. We never saw any parent compound. Final example I'm going to go through is polyaromatic hydrocarbon work. So this was done at Oregon State. PAHs are common combustion products. The small ones are typically inhaled, naphthalene or pyrene. Large ones tend to fall out onto things and are ingested in foods. The EPA priority pollutants list has 16 PAHs. Dibenzocrisine, or DBC, is not on that list, but it is a probable human carcinogen. We know it's metabolically activated to form DNA addicts. So in a human exposure study, 29 nanograms of DBC, those 5 nanocuries of carbon-14, were given to volunteers. This is the equivalent amount of BAP that you'd find in smoked meat. It's about 30% of the average daily intake of PAHs. The radiation dose was equivalent to 5 bananas. And nobody worries too much about a 5 banana dose. So here is a structure of DBC. There was also animal work done. PBPK curves were constructed for mouse and rat, and these dots are averages of 6 humans. You can see that in all cases, the DBC fairly quickly got into circulation. It comes down relatively quickly, but the humans doesn't seem to go down as fast as the rodents. We have some level going out quite a ways, but the important thing to see is here we have a little bit of a bump. Now that suggests that there may be a metabolite that was growing in. So you could have compound that was going down just like the animals, but you could have a metabolite that was growing in here to get that kind of a shape. So the next thing to do is probably look to see how to do a metabolism study. So this comes to recent advances that we've done with AMS. I described with atrazine, we did fraction collection, which is extremely tedious if you have long elution. So for the atrazine, it was a 45-minute elution. the time to analyze each one of those graphite samples is about 5 minutes. So approximately 250 minutes of analysis time on the accelerator to do that trace. What we've done, this work really spearheaded by Ted Ognobin at Livermore, is develop a way to measure the an LC trace directly. So basically turn the AMS into a detector for an LC. So what he's done is come up with a way to spray the eluent on a moving wire, remove the solvent, so remove the mobile phase, combust the compounds of interest to carbon dioxide, and then inject them into the accelerator. So this is a picture of our new compact accelerator at Livermore. So this is part of that moving wire system, and ion source is right here. So the CO2 is then injected, and then instead of making a sputtering graphite to get negative charged carbon, we are doing basically the same thing with carbon dioxide. So the big advantage here is that we have a direct measurement without going through the cumbersome process of making graphite. In the last year, we have also added a mass spec that is mated with the UPLC, and then we have a flow splitter so we can split the eluent between the mass spec and the AMS as needed, so we can get molecular identification with the MS and quantitation with the AMS. So this is work that was published actually just late last year, identifying metabolites of DBC. So this was done before the MS was online. So we identify metabolites with coelution of standards, and still like to do that, even with the MS. So this top graph here is, our standards. We have tetraols of DBC, a diol, and DBC parent compound. In the lower part, you've got the 14C particles and the carbon-12 current that we're measuring. So we're doing 14 to 12 here. The solvent front comes through. The tetraols, M1, 2, 3, and 3, are measured. We have the diol. These compounds, these metabolites, were not measured, or were not identified. We measured peaks. So there's work going on now to identify those. Important point here is that the analyses are as fast as UPLC. So instead of 250 minutes, we analyze a trace in 25 minutes on the spectrometer. So it's an order of magnitude faster of what we did previously, which is a big, big improvement. So take-home messages, the AMS enables human ADME, PK, and biomarker studies using environmentally relevant exposures. We have great sensitivity and specificity, essentially no radiological hazard above accepted risks. Nobody worries about radiation from bananas. We really reduce the chemical hazards as well, because we're looking at levels of chemicals that are similar to what people are exposed to already. We believe that it's best to study humans using humans. Really follows ELARA principles. ELARA comes out of radiological protection, as low as reasonably achievable. We can really take the radiological hazard out of human studies. We also, in many cases, take the chemical hazard out because we're working with much lower levels. And the new sample interface really streamlines analyses. Where are we going in the future? Well, we want to continue to automate and simplify the processing. The liquid sample interface with the gas injection really can eliminate graphite processing entirely. Okay, UPLC, AMS makes large-scale LC viable. And in the last 2 weeks, we were awarded a patent for measuring C14 CO2 with a laser, which would get rid of the accelerator and be able to basically do the same studies with a laser system at the detector. So with that, I'd like to thank collaborators, contributors, and funding, people at Livermore, the Oregon State SRP, Davis SRP, other people, and a variety of places, the grants. I'm just listed. I'm not going to mention them. And this is our website. If you are interested in using AMS, you can go there and contact us. In some ways, we're very similar to the synchrotron light sources. Talk to somebody at our center to help you design experiments and figure out how to do things. So with that, I'd like to take questions.
Thank you, Bruce. You can still submit questions using the Q&A pod in the lower right corner of the screen. And if there's questions on the phone, please press #6 to unmute your phone and please ask your questions. I'm going to read a couple from the Q&A section for the presentation here. I have a question that says, how is combustion done experimentally to account for carbon dioxide?
We have, for graphite, we have sealed tubes. So we evacuate tubes, and the quartz tubes, and seal them with a torch. So we really limit the CO2 that will be coming in from outside. For the moving wire system, we have a helium stream that carries the material. And the CO2 in the atmosphere is very low by comparison to combusting the sample. Mm-hmm. Maybe between parts per million, a couple hundred parts per million, and it's quite high when we're actually combusting a sample in a small volume.
And the person asking the questions had that, seems a confusion about, you know, you did mention carbon dioxide some places, and other places you mentioned graphite.
There are two different ways. The old way of doing AMS is by graphite, and we still do graphite quite a bit because it's a great material for ionite, making negative ions. We are moving towards injecting the gas directly because making graphite is cumbersome. You can speed up analyses if you can do CO2.
Okay.
And it's basically, how are you delivering the carbon to your ion source?
Right.
You can deliver it as CO2. You can deliver it as graphite. You can do either one.
Okay. And graphite being pure carbon and the CO2, it'll have oxygen in there. Is there any issues with having oxygen in the analyte?
Because we have a mass spectrometer, so when we ionize it, most of it is singly ionized, single compound. You could get some carbon CH, some CH2 also. AMS operates at much higher voltages than most mass spec techniques, and the molecules are destroyed during the charge-changing process. So we inject a negative ion, accelerate it, tear it apart, and then actually measure positive ions in the detector.
Okay. That's all the questions I had in the Q&A section. Are there any other questions on the phone line? And if there's not, there's one that just came in here. It's a notation to say highly saline solutions may cause problems.
Yes, if you have really high sodium, there can be issues.
Okay.
But there are ways of changing the solution. Again, that's if you have a system where you have really high salt. Contact people that at our center, and we have strategies of reducing sodium content.
Okay. And then the last question that I have from online is, what is the MS on the HPLC system?
I don't want to give an endorsement of a specific system. It's one that came as a package with the UPLC. It's the same manufacturer.
Okay.
But it's a coupled UPLC MS.
Okay. And then another question just came in regarding the same individual that mentioned the high saline solution issues. It says, basically this isn't an issue with oil or gas fluids? I don't know how to interpret that.
I'm not sure either. And there are ways of doing double tube combustions. So if it would be an issue, it's something we would have to do a trial to figure out how to get around it. I don't think it would be an issue.
Okay, I think the clear. Go ahead.
If the sample is a liquid, like a liquid oil, the amount of liquid is very small because there's a lot of carbon in it. You'd be looking at a sample that's probably 5 microliters or less. So I don't think it would be an issue. When we do urine, it's a couple hundred microliters of mostly water. Those tend to be among the more salty samples that we do measure.
Oh, I think we just got the clarification to the question. It had to do with oil and gas fracturing fluids. With sodium, I don't know if it's sodium levels, but I do know they have high ionic load in the fracking fluids. And they're saying the concentration is around 2,000 parts per million. So that would have to be diluted before running through the system?
Probably, but it's something we've not run that.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't tell you without actually trying to troubleshoot it.
Yeah, and there's more ions in there than just sodium for the fracturing.
Yeah. Now, sodium is the one that causes problems for us.
All right, that's all the questions online. And we don't have any from the phone line. So, Dr. Buchholz, thank you very much for your presentation.
Okay. Thank you.
Now we're going to hear from Dr. Lee Ferguson. And Dr. Ferguson is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Duke University. He's also an environmental analytical chemist who joined Duke in 2009 after 6 years as an assistant professor in the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at the University of South Carolina. Research in the Ferguson Laboratory is focused on development of novel methods for trace analysis of organic and nanoparticulate contaminants in the aquatic environment. The analytical methods developed in the Ferguson Laboratory are applied to both process-oriented environmental chemistry experiments in the field and the laboratory, as well as to toxicity bioassays, including whole organism assays and molecular endpoints. The overarching goal is to gain an increased understanding of how emerging contaminants are transported, transformed, and induce deleterious effects within aquatic systems. So if we can move on here, let me see the slides. Yes, the slides are loaded up. So Dr. Ferguson, go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. So what I'm going to talk about today is a case study of how we use high-resolution mass spectrometry to do non-targeted analysis of mixtures of organic contaminants. In this case, I'll be talking about mostly the indoor environment. We also use these techniques for measuring compounds in the aquatic environment as well. In my laboratory, we spend a lot of time looking at emerging contaminants, and so one of the overarching questions that we have is what are the next emerging contaminants, what are the most relevant emerging contaminants, and how do we find them best in the environment? And so, of course, many of these emerging contaminants that we think about are things like personal care products, pharmaceuticals, things like surfactants and shampoos and these sorts of compounds, and through our daily use and through commercial uses, they can cause issues for exposure of both humans as well as ecosystems. And so this is one of my favorite scientific cartoons that I thought I would show here just to illustrate how we have evolved as environmental analytical chemists in parallel to how genomics and proteomics have evolved. So here we see the typical original approach of how we analyze biological activities, this sort of geneticism and biochemists fishing for individual proteins here, And then over here now we see the new approach, Department of Genomics and Proteomics. This was sort of the idea, this was back from 2001, published in Science. This was the idea that suddenly we were going to have the ability to now look at multiple activities simultaneously in biological systems and understand systems biology. Now, we can also make the parallel to how we've evolved as analytical chemists measuring pollutants in the environment. From the 1970s up until about 2010, we approached this problem much as the lone biochemist or molecular biologist here. And then starting around 2010 and now advancing towards the end of the decade, we're really starting to apply high-resolution mass spectrometry and other methods similar to that in ways that are in parallel to techniques such as proteomics and genomics in order to assess exposure and identification and occurrence of multiple contaminants in a much more holistic way. And so what I want to do is sort of go through how we use high-resolution mass spectrometry, specifically LC, liquid chromatography, with high-resolution mass spectrometry as an emerging technique for environmental exposomics. How do we define the exposome? And so when we start, we can think of ways that we do analysis of pollutants in the environment. The conventional way to do this is with targeted screening, where we have a simple question looking for a few particular compounds present in any given sample. This is sort of the traditional way that we do this using triple quadrupole mass spectrometry, for example. We can also consider the suspect analysis, suspect screening. If we have a list of compounds, this may be a prioritized list due to regulations, regulatory action, or perhaps prior knowledge of a sample, we can ask which compounds on that list might be present in a particular sample, whether it's environmental or biological. And so this also relies both on prior knowledge of the system as well as use of, in many cases, high-resolution mass spectrometry, as I'll show you. More modern techniques, more recently, we have started to do what's termed non-target analysis, where we ask a very open question just about which compounds might be present in the sample overall. And so we can sort of compare this with Donald Rumsfeld's famous quotes about known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns. So in the case of targeted analysis, we're really looking for compounds that are known to our laboratory and known to science. On the other hand, for non-targeted analysis, in many cases, we are looking for what are called known unknowns. These are compounds that are unknown to the sample but might be known to science, as well as unknown unknowns. A good example of this is metabolites that we might not anticipate in our samples. So one question we might ask is why must we use high-resolution mass spectrometry for doing non-targeted analysis of pollutants? And this really comes down to our ability to discriminate mixtures and to identify a particular molecular formula. So here is just a graphic showing a typical isotope profile of a compound that has a monoisotopic mass around 235, in this case 235.18136. Measured at three different resolutions, and you can see that at a resolution of 500, we have broad peaks. We can observe the isotopes, the C13 and 2C13 isotopes here. At higher resolution, resolution of 5,000, we begin to narrow these peaks and can fully separate these isotope clusters. And then finally, at a resolution of 50,000 here, we can see very, very well defined peaks that are highly separated, and therefore we can begin to address mixtures where you might have other compounds which have masses that occur in between these peaks. Simultaneously with this, we can also introduce the concept of mass error, and that is specifically how well can we define this monoisotopic mass as well as the isotope masses for this these particular molecules. And this is given in part per million units. And we can think of a typical low-resolution mass spectrometer, like a quadrupole mass spectrometer, might give around 500 part per million mass accuracy. This would be about 0.1 Dalton at this particular mass. For higher resolution and more stable mass analyzers, we might have 50 part per million. And then for the more high-resolution instruments with very stable mass measurement, we can have up to 5 part per million and lower. And so here you can see that we can measure our mass to 3 decimal places. In our case, we're for most of the work I'll show today, we're using an Orbitrap mass spectrometer with a resolution of about 100,000 and a mass error less than 2 part per million. So for a mass somewhere around 200 Daltons, we're talking about a measurement error down around 0.5 millidaltons. So this gives us the ability to very, very precisely measure our mass as well as to separate our compounds from nearly near isobaric interferences. And this gives great advantages when we're dealing with complex environmental mixtures. So what I'm going to talk about is a case study where we're looking at semi-volatile organic contaminants in the indoor environment to sort of define this exposome. Basically, what we're doing here is looking at what compounds we use in our daily lives and that might be present in the indoor environment, which may cause issues for human exposure. So far, we've mostly looked at semi-volatile organic contaminants in the ambient environment. There haven't been that many studies and very few comprehensive studies on human exposure indoors. Where do these compounds come from? Well, they can come from household products, things like personal care products that can release phthalates. We all know about bisphenol A in water bottles, surfactants and other cleaning agents, and things that might be present in food packaging. We also have flame retardants and other additives that are used in furniture and electronics. In many cases, these are chemicals that are applied to our consumer products to enhance performance or durability. So why should we study semi-volatile organic contaminants indoors? Some of these compounds may be endocrine disruptors. A well-known case is bisphenol A, as well as many of the flame retardants that have been shown to act on the thyroid hormone receptor and exert toxicity this way. Also, well, greater than 87% of our time is spent indoors, typically, and so we have a high level of exposure potential through inhalation, ingestion, things like dermal absorption. And so our objective in this study was to assess human exposure to semi-volatile organic contaminants through a non-targeted analysis of paired house dust and human hand wipe samples. So we're going to look at comparisons of these two types of matrices. So what's our analytical strategy? Well, in most cases in the past, indoor exposure analysis has been applied using gas chromatography mass spectrometry. In this case, we're really focusing on nonpolar organic contaminants. So what we've really tried to do now is focus on some of the more semipolar or polar organic contaminants using liquid chromatography with high-resolution mass spec, and then use some data analytics and novel analytics to do de novo identification and then prioritize compounds with high exposure potential. So we really consider that this approach complements the more targeted approaches such as LC tandem mass spec or GCMS for SVOC analysis. So what we've done here, in our case, we've done a pilot study with 10 separate households where we've collected house dust as well as hand wipes together with some dust wipes and wipe blanks from these 10 households. We've done some sample, sample preparation. And then we've split our analyses into really two different types here. First of all, we've done a more traditional single-dimension liquid chromatography analysis with Orbitrap mass spectrometry. And this is where most of our high-resolution MS-based non-target analysis is focused, is on this side. However, as I'll show you, there for several reasons, we've also applied comprehensive two-dimensional liquid chromatography. This is LC-LC. In combination also with Orbitrap mass spectrometry to isolate and resolve some interfering compounds. So this, just to explain a little more about our comprehensive 2D UHPLC, this is LC crossed with LC. How do we get from our sample all the way to basically a 2D chromatogram, 3D plot? The way that we do this is with first a first dimension separation, which is a relatively slow separation, oftentimes isocratic. We go to a switching valve and then to a second, much faster separation, 2-minute fast gradients with two identical columns that are that are used in alternating fashion. Then these come back together at our analysis, and then we can generate our 2D chromatograms. So to have effective separation, what we really need is orthogonal separation between our first dimension and our second dimension. So for example, we often use size or hydrophobicity, or we can use hydrophilic interaction and hydrophobicity as our two separation phases. So here's just a picture or a diagram of our setup here. Our sample is injected onto our first dimension separation. This is either hydrophilic interaction chromatography or size exclusion chromatography. The elution from that first dimension comes to a switching valve where it's loaded onto one of our second dimension fast short HPLC columns, UHPLC columns, while the second column, which has already been loaded in the prior valve switch, is now eluted by a low hold-up high-pressure gradient pump into our mass spectrometer. And so this valve here switches every 2 minutes where we have ballistic gradients from this pump here into our LC. So this gives us the ability to generate high-frequency switching 2D comprehensive liquid chromatographs. So how do we do our data processing? Well, so in this case, when we're doing non-targeted chemical analysis, we use some software called Compound Discoverer for consolidating our peaks and filtering. So what does this look like? So in the present case, where we're looking at house dust and hand wipes and organic contaminants in these matrices, so when we put all of the data together, we have about 34,000 features. These are individual components that are present in the samples in positive ion mode and about 8,300 in negative mode. And this really represents the difference in the efficiency of ionization in electrospray ionization for the compounds that we're observing in these type of samples. So here's a map of those of all of those compounds by mass to charge ratio versus retention time on our first dimension, our single dimension LC. So we do some data processing. Subtracting the blank really doesn't change the number of features very much. But then now we start to look at which compounds in this full data set are shared by all dust and all hand wipe samples. We can really isolate down to the most prevalent compounds. And what you can see is that only 90 of those compounds were shared in all dust and all wipe samples across the 10 households in positive mode and 6 in negative mode. And so what you can see when you look at the patterns here is we have some distinct contours that seem to be apparent on the elution patterns between mass to charge ratio versus time. So we wanted to explore those. It turns out that 83% of these compounds turn out to be non-ionic surfactants. And so this is where we've really used our comprehensive 2D LC-LC high-res mass spec analysis to great effect. In this case, here you can see on the X axis here, we have our first dimension retention time here. You can see it goes from 0 to about 80 minutes. And then on the second dimension, the retention time is in seconds, 0 to 120 seconds. So here we have size separation on the X axis and hydrophobicity separation on the Y axis. So you can see some repeating patterns here, some features. And so if we isolate those and look at what they are, turns out that these are polyethoxylated surfactant series. Here we have alkyl phenolethoxylates, in this case nonyl phenolethoxylate and octyl phenolethoxylates, as well as some alcohol ethoxylates, as well as polyethylene glycol. These are compounds that are used in cleaning products as well as personal care products, and we find them to be ubiquitous in the indoor environment. So we wanted to do some analysis on this and see if there were any correlations between the area of these surfactants in on the hand wipe versus the paired dust sample. And so, as you can see, this is just about, this is for a variety of different surfactants that we isolated. You can see that this is just about the worst correlation that you could possibly imagine. There was almost no correlation, actually there was, of course, no correlation between the area on the hand wipe versus the dust. And so the question is, why might this be? We considered that this is most likely due to, in certain cases, decoupled sources. So the sources of these surfactants to the house dust might not be the same as the sources on the hand wipes. For example, the surfactants on the hand wipes may be related to hand washing activities, where the surfactants in the dust may actually be related to hard surface cleaner activities. And we can see some evidence of that if we look at the polyethoxamer distribution, the distribution of the polymer series within the nonylphenol ethoxylate and the alcohol ethoxylate, C14 alcohol ethoxylate series. You can see that for certain people, the gray here is the dust, the orange is the hand wipes. In certain cases, you see a very similar pattern between the hand wipe and the dust. In other cases, you see very different patterns, also suggesting different sources, and this is also true for the alcohol ethoxylates. So the question becomes then, what else is present in these samples? Here we have these 90 features, 87% of these that are shared among all 10 of the hand wipe and paired dust samples are non-ionic surfactant, but now we can go back to our original list of 33,000 compounds in positive ion and start to wonder what some of these other prevalent compounds are. One way that we can do the analysis here is to require that the compounds be present in at least one dust and hand wipe pair. So we decrease our number of features by roughly a factor of 10 here, down to about 4,000. And then so we also did a cutoff at a particular mass spectral peak area, greater than 55,000. Now we've really isolated the most abundant compounds that are occurring in both hand wipes and dust that are paired from the same household. So now we have about 500 compounds in positive ion mode and about 70 compounds in negative mode. So the question is, how do we go about identifying these? Once we subtract our surfactants, of course, now we're down to about 300. So how do we go about identifying these compounds? So the question is, we start with exact mass. How do we go to an identified compound? So what we have here is the information is we have our chromatograms with extracted ion chromatograms for specific masses of interest. We can look beneath those peaks to get mass spectra. So here our mass spectrum shows a compound with a M over Z of 531.4. Our instrument, the way that our workflow is set up is that we fragment this ion to form a tandem mass spectra, which contains information about the structure of this this compound here. And so what we were trying to do is use this information to go from a mass to a structure. And so we have some methods that we can use to approach this. The first thing that we have to do is generate our molecular formula. This is our vital first step towards our structural identification. So in this case, we have a tandem mass spectrum from a prominent compound in our house dust and hand wipe samples. In this case, we can use a 5 part per million mass range to come up with about 16 possibilities of our of potential molecular formula. We use a software program called Sirius to then do fragment tree analysis here, which then attempts to rationalize the molecular formula of the fragments and come up with a parent molecular formula that best explains the tandem mass spectrum. And so in this case, we've got a very good fit for this particular molecular formula here. The highest scoring molecular formula, C30H5805S1 at this particular mass. So that we can consider that a good formula candidate from which we can then start to look for molecular structures. So we can also use some additional information, ultra-high resolution mass spectrometry that is capable. So these Orbitrap mass spectrometers are capable of obtaining ultra-high resolution in certain cases. Here we have an experimental isotope pattern for this compound at 116,000 resolution. If we simulate the spectrum at that same resolution for our top candidate formula, now we see a very good match at the zoomed out stage. If we zoom in now on our M plus 2 isotope cluster here, you can see that in our experimental spectrum, this is actually two peaks. We have two peaks here. The first one explained by C13, the second one here, or this third one here, or, excuse me, second one here explained by our S34. And so then if we simulate some of our potential formulas, you can see that the best match again here is given by our C30H5805S1. This is what's called isotope fine structure. And so isotope fine structure can give us some additional confirmation about our molecular formulas. So if we then take that molecular formula and interrogate databases, in this case, We're interrogating the CAST database using the SciFinder tool. In this case, we get six possible structures that are known in CAST with that formula. And so what we've done is sort by the number of references with the assumption that compounds that are present in our samples are probably going to be derived from commercial products and have been used in and have been referenced or patented. Our top hit here is a compound, it's a propanoic acid sulfonyl derivative here. So this compound, if we then look at some of the references that have been published for it, we can find that it turns out this is known as an interference leached from plastic tubes. So we've got a paper which actually has measured tandem mass spectra for this compound. Here's our literature-based spectrum for this compound. Here's our experimental spectrum, and you can see that many of the fragments are in common. And so this is a good indication that we have a high-quality tentative match, in this case, for this polymer additive compound. We've also been able to rationalize these fragments using some in silico tandem mass spec methods, which explain these fragments further. We can also use other strategies. So in this case, we have a database of about 32,000 compounds that we've curated in-house here at Duke, which we can do a search using molecular formula to find compounds such as this NN-bis 2-hydroxyethyl dodecanamide, which has been reported in by the, through EPA national production volume somewhere between 1 million and 10 million pounds per year. National production volume, this is a high production volume polymer additive. So we've also gotten tentative identification through our in silico mass MS2 prediction. Finally, we can use some online tools. This is a case where we're interrogating the mass bank mass spectral library as well as using some in silico fragmentation tools combined in an approach called MetFusion to take our experimental mass spectrum and match it against library mass spectra here. In this case, this is the pesticide imidacloprid. Here's our mirror plot showing the very, very high quality match, very good mass bank score. Imidacloprid, why might we find this in the indoor environment? Turns out it's used for indoor pesticides as well as on pets in some cases. So here just is a summary of how we use these workflows. So we start with our exact mass. We use a molecular formula generator to give us our molecular formula, which we can then use to either interrogate online databases such as CAF through SciFinder, in-house databases through a database application, as well as online resources for in silico fragmentation to then get to a tentative identification. Ultimately, we'll use standards to give a confirmed ID and have a final identification and hopefully quantitation. So just to give you an idea of what our results look like for this set of 10 paired hand wipe and dust samples. So in this case, the wipe is on the left, the dust is on the right in these boxes. We've organized this according to compound class. So in here you can see that we have lots of organophosphates. These in many cases are flame retardants as well as polymer additives that are found in both hand wipes and dust, paired hand wipe and dust samples. In many cases, we have authentic standards for these compounds, and we've been able to confirm them, to confirm their identity. Surfactants, again, are very abundant in both the hand wipes as well as the house dust, not surprising because they're used for in both consumer products as well as hard surface cleaners and cleaning products, shampoo, et cetera. Polymer additives. Polymer additives were very commonly identified both with standards as well as tentative ID within hand wipes as well as our dust. Here's an example. These are caprolactam multimers. These are byproducts of polymerization, specifically of polymers such as nylon, and they're used in many cases also for food packaging. We also see some compounds that are known to leach from plastics, so polymer additives seem to be an important class of compounds for indoor exposure. Pesticides, and then also some natural products, things like oxidation products of cooking oil here, dilinoleum, as well as piperine, which is something that comes from black pepper, actually. So just to wrap up here in conclusion, what I've shown, hopefully, is that two-dimensional LC high-resolution accurate mass spec. This is a very powerful tool for analysis of semi-volatile organic contaminants in dust as well as hand wipe samples. So when we're really trying to define this this exposome of the indoor environment for human exposure, this is a really great tool for looking at a much more holistic picture of the compounds that might be present in these samples. We can sort of develop these non-targeted data analysis workflows to get this holistic view. And so this really gives us a much broader view of exposure relative to more conventional targeted analysis, which is what we've typically been doing. In our case, we were able to, in this specific case study, get 213 tentative and confirmed identification from our 567 filtered components. These are components which had high abundance and were present in at least one dust or hand wipe sample. So this is roughly a third, a little over a third of our filtered features. We've been able to get tentative and confirmed IDs using this workflow. Quantitatively, the most dominant compounds in these samples were definitely the non-ionic surfactants. This is things like nonylphenol ethoxylates and alcohol ethoxylates, which really are compounds that, at least for the nonylphenol ethoxylates, have been known for quite some time to be precursors of the endocrine disruptors. And the alcohol ethoxylates are not typically known as endocrine disruptors, but they are toxic, for example, to aquatic organisms. Okay, so with that, I'll just go ahead and thank the funding agencies that have supported this, certainly Superfund through our analytical chemistry core. And I will mention that our laboratory is setting these methods up as a service center for a Center for Environmental Exposomics here at Duke. And so this is supported both through the Superfund program as well as through grants from NIH and EPA, as well as partnership with Thermo Fisher Scientific. And so I'll thank my group and you for your attention, and I can take any questions.
Thank you, Lee. Now, if there are any questions from the audience, please submit your questions through the Q&A pod you see in the lower right corner of your screen. And if you're calling in and would like to do it over the phone line, please press #6 to open your unmute your phone line and ask your question. So I'll move now to the questions we received in the Q&A pod. So the first question was, did the same team collect all your samples, like the hand wipe and the surface?
Yes, that was all done by my collaborator, Professor Heather Stapleton. Her team did all of the collection and the sample preparation, all using the same methods.
Very good, thank you. The next question is the presenter aware of any non-targeted compounds that might show up on the mass spec in the naphthalene range?
On the naphthalene range. So one of the limitations of the technique that I'm using here, this is LC electrospray mass spectrometry, is that it's not typically sensitive to things like polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Compounds that are pure hydrocarbons don't ionize very well. That's a great example of where you might want to use a complementary non-targeted method such as GC high-resolution mass spectrometry to catch those kinds of compounds. That's a good question.
Okay, and then the follow-on with that was, is there a good reference source or database for evaluating the peaks? I guess, if you wanted to use the library to figure out what you're seeing.
Sure. Yeah, that's one of the big challenges with this work is identifying what is the proper database. So which databases are the best ones to use and which ones are available. The most comprehensive database that exists is CAS. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to use in an open access automated way because it's proprietary, and really the only way to access it is using sort of the web portal through SciFinder. However, all is not lost. There are good alternatives, PubChem, which is actually administered through the NIH, and then also ChemSpider, which is, I think, sponsored through Royal Society of Chemistry, are great open access chemical databases. Now, those are just databases. They don't typically include things like spectral libraries. However, there are a number of spectral libraries available also online for free. The one that I highlighted here in this presentation was MassBank, which I think is hosted in Japan but mirrored in Europe as well as in the U.S., I think through UC Davis, MassBank of North America. And then also there is a commercial database that is called MZ Cloud, which is it is commercial, but it's also available for free to use through a web portal. And those are all resources that are really essential for doing non-targeted analysis for both finding compounds that might be good candidates, as well as a library spectra that you can use to identify. So there's still a lot of work still to be done to cull down and try to get the most relevant databases and that are prioritized with particular things like production volume. One thing, I'll mention one more database, and that is EPA's CompTox database. There's a website which is available it's the chemistry dashboard that is maintained by the EPA's National Center for Computational Toxicology. Their DSS Tox database beneath that has about 700,000 compounds that are relevant as environmental contaminants.
Very good. And now, going forward with looking at the different compounds that you see from those dust or wipe samples, the next question is about PFOA and PFOS. You know this is coming. PFOA and PFOS, because it's such a hot topic right now. Are you seeing any fluorinated compounds in your dust or hand wipes?
Yes. In this case, it was buried right here. PFOS, we certainly saw in several of the samples. I sort of included that into the surfactant tab because technically it is a surfactant, although of course we don't use it typically as a cleaning agent. So yes, we do see perfluorinated compounds in these samples. And as you can see, they certainly weren't the most abundant compounds that we see, and that is typically what we've observed in many environmental samples. While we do see the presence of perfluorinated compounds, they don't tend to be the dominant organic compounds in the samples, and that's true also for these hand wipes and dust.
Thank you. Moving to our next question, do you obtain MS-MS spectra concurrently in the same run as MS1 spectra, or do you target compound of interest in subsequent injections after selecting those that you're more interested in?
Yeah, that's a good question. We do it all in one run typically. We do what's termed data-dependent tandem mass spectrum acquisition. However, in some cases, we will go back and rerun samples in order to try to catch with targeted lists for MS-MS spectra isolation when the compounds of interest were not selected for MS-MS in the first analysis. And so that is necessary sometimes because the rate of MS-MS acquisition is not always sufficient for these instruments to keep up with the number of compounds eluding from the column at any given time. The instruments are getting faster and faster, but in some cases we do have to go back and rerun to acquire the MS2 data that we need.
Now we're getting into the analytical questions now, as you could tell there. So the next one is, did you identify compounds in the ESI negative mode?
So we did. In fact, actually, on this slide here, the compounds that are highlighted right now with the red box, these are all sulfate and sulfonate surfactants. These were all identified in negative ion mode. So the negative ion mode, even though there are fewer compounds, the spectra tend to be much simpler, and in many cases we can make an assumption, a much easier assumption about what the ionization mechanism was, just simply deprotonation mostly. And so it's a little easier to come up with the molecular formula. However, that said, unfortunately, the tandem mass spectra in negative ion or mode is often less easy to interpret manually or with in silico approaches.
Okay. The next question was more comment, and it pointed towards the comptox.epa.gov website. It is just that, comptox.epa.gov/dashboard, if people are interested.
Yes, that's the one I was referring to, and that's an excellent resource. It's got lots of information, including physical chemical properties, as well as functional use data, which is really, really useful for trying to isolate and rationalize non-target identification. So anybody who's interested in this kind of work, I encourage to make use of that resource.
Yeah, thank you. Then the next question is, okay, it's pretty long here. Here we go. Have there been any studies involving occupational exposures that utilize synchrotron, laser ablation, AMS techniques to characterize contaminants or metabolites? I think this is from our other presenters as well as you. In other words, studies involving occupational worker exposures versus environmental exposures to chemicals. My goodness.
Well, for the accelerator stuff, I'm going to have to defer to Bruce, I think. I wouldn't know.
Yeah. Anything on with your work?
With the for occupational exposure? I have not seen that work. Doesn't mean it hasn't been done, but I will say this is the application of non-targeted analysis in environmental and occupational and, you know, ecological research, exposomics research is really in its infancy. This is a method that really has gone from 0 to 60 miles an hour in less than 5 years. And so there's still a lot of applications to be done. There's still a lot of technology development that's being done. So there's a lot of things that haven't been done yet, including probably that.
Yeah. That's all the questions I have from the Q&A section. So I'm going to urge folks on the phone, if you want to use your phone to ask questions, #6 to unmute. If there aren't more questions. Oh, go ahead.
I'm frantically Googling to see if synchrotron has been used for, and it has. There's lots of studies. There's one study on steel dust in the New York City subway system in the lungs of workers using synchrotron. So yeah, it has, to answer that question with a yes for synchrotron and laser. I'm not sure about laser ablation. I'm still Googling.
Yeah. Thank you for looking into that. The other question, and this is to your presentation. Are there any, in addition to your hand wipes samples, have you done any passive sampling?
Not in this case. We do passive sampling quite often for aquatic sampling, for aquatic measurements. My colleague Heather Stapleton, who did the sampling here, she's done indoor passive sampling for analyzing more volatile compounds using GCMS. We have not tried any of that on the indoor side for non-target. Be interesting to do, though.
Mm-hmm. Other questions from the phone line?
A comment from Bruce about the occupational exposures for AMS. We're not giving people a labeled material in an occupational setting, but we look at dose rates of what are considered occupational exposures. Now we have also been working on looking at naphthalene, but that's also in animal models for inhalation at this point. But that work is underway and not yet published.
Any other questions or comments? That was excellent. Okay. Getting close to our time too. So before we conclude, I wanted to make sure everyone's aware of the related URLs pod on your screen, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. So on the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topics. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place the seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also in the related URLs pod, you'll find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms for our presentations. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event if you need that for hours, training hours. And then there should be one more slide here, new ways to stay connected. I'd like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. So for more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the cluin.org website, the EPA Cleanup Tech Facebook page, and follow the EPA Cleanup Tech on Twitter, and join the Cleanup Information Network, which is CLUIN. There's a LinkedIn group for that, so if you wanted to join and follow that, that would be good. And visit the SRP Risk e-learning webpage, and follow SRP_NIEHS on Twitter. So now for our shameless advertising plug, join us for the third session. We'd like to encourage you to join us for our third and final session of this seminar series on June 12th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. So during the third session, speakers will highlight tools and methods to detect contaminants, including PCBs, PFAS, and chlorinated volatile organic contaminants, and measure their fate in transport in the environment. So the speakers for that seminar will be Carrie Hornbuckle from the University of Iowa, Jennifer Guelfo from Brown University, and Mark Brousseau from the University of Arizona. So as we come up now on 3 p.m., let's conclude. And if you submitted an online question and we didn't have time to get to it, we'll send your question to the presenter, the appropriate presenter. If you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email. I think all of you have that information, the attendees have that information. Our email addresses are on the presenter tab in the CLUIN seminar homepage. There we go. So I'd like to thank our presenters today, Tracy Punchin, Bruce Buchholz, and Lee Ferguson, for their time in preparing and sharing their presentations with all of us today.